All right, we've got Dr. Richardson, who's about to present for us right now. He received his PhD from the Department of Counseling and Psychological Services at Georgia State University. He's a professor and the clinical director of the RTS MFT and Counseling Program. He's an AAMFT Clinical Fellow, an AAMFT Approved Supervisor, an Ethics Chairperson for the MAMFT, and has been a practicing therapist for over 30 years. Dr. Richardson's research and writing has focused on the psychoeducation interventions, parenting and Christian integration of internal family systems therapy, developed by Richard Schwartz, a systemic self-psychology intervention model. Many of you are aware of that. He's also a dear friend of mine. He loves riding bikes. If you want to talk to him about riding bikes, that's sort of a passion of his. He has a recumbent bike, which I don't know if any of you know how hard that is to ride, but for me, it's just impossible. But that's his love. And we're so thankful that you're here and that you're going to present this today. Thanks.
Thanks, Barb. We have so many things to talk about together. And it's a little hard to get started talking. At an alumni conference, what happens is you, if you're me, you see people that you dearly love and that you spend a lot of time with that at my age almost are like children, many of them. My children are 33 and 35. But you all are children that have left and gone away, but it's wonderful to see you come back. It's hard to get started because I want to fellowship with you. But we'll do just that. We'll get started. As I was thinking about, well, what do we talk about in the field of ethics? It seemed to me that these two topics, same-sex marriage, the issues of reparation therapy, and teletherapy or online education or e-therapy, those internet things, that those are primary topics in our culture, in our profession, that are moving so quickly that it's actually hard to find ethical guidelines on these things, as we'll discover as we go through. So let's move and address these. I'm going to start with the internet because that's easier to talk about for me. Not because I'm a cyber geek, but because the information there is not as challenging to present and discuss. Interesting thing that's happened in the last 2 years. In the world of marriage and family therapy and accredited programs, there are now two fully accredited programs by CO-AMFTE, which is the accrediting arm of AAMFT, the Marriage and Family Therapy Movement, that are completely online. They're online education for this relationship behavior called therapy, which is fascinating. A couple of years ago, I attended a workshop by a gentleman who was then heading up the North Central University. That MA does not stand for Massachusetts, and the MS does not stand for Mississippi. Those are the degrees that are offered by those programs. Not that it really makes that much difference where they are, since they are online and distance education, but North Central is in Phoenix, and Capella is based in Minnesota. So that's a fascinating model. The especially when it comes to supervision, and what that looks like for these programs is that persons who are studying there, going through these programs, find internship sites, pre-masters at their local level, and those folks contract to do on-site supervision. But there is online supervision as well. The group meets online with a software that they use and they can watch recorded sessions. They can even watch live sessions together. And the supervision group can converse with one another and the supervisor. So that's a change. That's something different. And at first, when I think about this, just to react to it a little bit, I think negatively. Like, you know, certainly the relational encounter of two persons sitting across from one another in pure Karkuffian style without any furniture in between them is the model that we're comfortable with and trust. What about this kind of supervision online? What about the relationship between the supervisor and the supervisee? The eventual spreading of more and more teletherapy actually occurring, not just supervision. What about that? And obviously, there are concerns, but persons also, obviously, develop deep relationships with one another through electronic means as well. Another topic. This is an article that you have in your references, and you can look up and you can find this online, especially if you're a member of AAMFT. Oh, by the way, Barb said I was a fellow in AAMFT. I am simply a clinical member and approved supervisor, not another level than that. This article talks about how technological things are being represented in the literature. And technological things here in this article spread from what happens with couples when the one or both members of the couples are engaged with other people, perhaps online, and those relationships are taking them away from relationships, or what happens when teenagers are involved in pornography online, all the way to how much teletherapy is actually being done between therapists and clients, and their assessment is that the academic addressing of these topics as represented in journals, in professional journals, is infrequent. And they judge that to be fairly meek and low percentages to troubling in some areas. So in other words, hello, Nina. I've seen you for a long time. In other words, as I mentioned earlier, and I think this will be a theme coming up for me over and over again, the academic information flow from our professional organizations is behind these rapidly moving fields. And what does that mean for us and how we are deciding those decisions, those ethical decisions that are so important to our clients? Electronic therapy itself is addressed now in virtually all of the professional mental health organizational codes of conduct. AMFT's code was published in most recently in 2.12, and item 1.14 does address that. So you've probably seen it and have looked at it. Then I wanted to take a look at these items. What does the American Psychological Association say about teletherapy, and what are they doing there? They're sort of the original relational therapist body in our country. Other codes of ethics are modeled after APA, certainly, and they have indeed taken the lead here. So you have a handout somewhere in your packet, not too far back, if you'll flip a page or two, you'll see APA and distance therapy. I have read a number of things for you all through this about many topics that we'll be discussing, And I've tried to summarize some of them for you, and I have referenced here an APA Monitor article from 2 years ago that that discusses that issue. I won't read that with you, but you can look it up and certainly read it later. What more, on the next page, probably the back side of that one in your handout, is something that came out very recently. A task force was assigned a few years ago for APA to look into this whole teletherapy world, and they actually have produced guidelines. And a couple of the interesting highlights are, firstly, the very broad definition of telepsychology or teletherapy, telecommunication technologies. And you'll see this about halfway down through that first big paragraph. Telecommunication technologies include, but are not limited to, telephone, mobile devices, interactive conferencing, email, chat, text, internet, websites, blogs, and so forth. And the information that is transmitted may be in writing or include images, sounds, or other data. So that's what they're trying to address, and in terms of using this means, any of these means, for therapy. At a previous conference, I addressed this topic for 3 hours specifically, and looked at various guidelines. And the guidelines haven't changed much. There are 7 guidelines developed by this task force, and they're the sort of things that we have been talking about before in other conferences, and that you are probably familiar with from other workshops and your own reading. And I want to make a note about these things. The way they're addressed by the task force, in my opinion, they aren't specifically prescribing ethical behavior. They are merely addressing these areas and saying that the therapist involved needs to pay particular attention to. So they don't exactly tell you what particular attention to means always. A few times they do, but basically, firstly, competence, and that means some training in some sort of teletherapy. Standard of care issues, especially they focus on client appropriateness for this mode of treatment, and they want the therapist to assess that, make sure that this is a client that would work well this way, and this is a topic or a problem they're working on that would make itself amenable to this. But that's about as far as they go. What exactly is amenable to this? Which clients are more likely to benefit, and which clients are likely not to benefit, isn't really addressed in these guidelines. And so I assume that's part of the furthering competence of item number one and continuing education. Informed consent, letting clients know that this is a different mode of therapy. The research on it is scant. And then there's many words addressing confidentiality of the security of actually the online work, security of the data that you're collecting, like session notes, and security in terms of how long do you retain and dispose of records. And once again, it's not a specific guideline, but they suggest that you address these things. And then that they, similarly about testing, they open the door, which surprised me a little bit, for psychologists at least, to consider what sort of testing could be done in this remote, distance sort of fashion. Well, as you can tell, I'm just doing a flyby here over this level of information or this over these topics. Oh, legal jurisdiction, of course. Yeah, being very, very careful about of licensure. This goes for marriage and family therapists, too. I think you'll know that there are some states, for instance, Alabama, that actually in their legal code at this point forbids somebody to do teletherapy in their state unless they're from another state, unless they're also licensed in Alabama. There are a number of states that do that relative to various professional licensure categories, so that's something that needs to be checked out. In your actual handout, page 1, And you might want to, I'm going to make a recommendation for you at this point. On this page one that you have that is an outline of where we're headed, you might want to just separate that out and put it next to you, because we'll be bouncing back and forth from this outline itself to the handouts that are referenced in it. You'll notice here under C1, APA Security, Jurisdiction, Emergency Services, it's another thing that's addressed. If you're doing therapy remotely, even in your own state in a more rural area for which this mode is particularly applicable, do you know the emergency services available in that area? And the recommendation is you need to. That's ethical practice. There's a statement about jurisdiction there, and an interesting point that is in that same handout, the APA guidelines, that they are hoping to see and perhaps foster the development of some sort of multi-jurisdictional licensure, a general licensure that states buy into, sign up for, that will allow therapists to be involved in some sort of tele or e-therapy across the country. Going back to the main outline now, American Telemedicine Organization, New Mississippi Law. There is an American Telemedicine Organization which probably comes closest to being authoritative talking about any kind of health care that's online, and many of those things are applicable to therapists of particular organizational stripes, psychologists, mental health counselors, and MFTs, and so forth. And Mississippi, actually, within the last 2 years, has created their own law regarding this topic. And a little bit later in the day, Terry Height's going to visit us and tell you what he's doing with Mississippi Children's Home Society and CARES and telemedicine and UMC. I think that'll be kind of interesting. You can check out that organization, and if you just Google that website and put Mississippi on it, you can read about the creation of this law in our own state, as I said, within the last 2 years. Only 16 states thus far have enacted these laws, and I think this is a move toward some sort of parity and commonality in jurisdiction. Well, that's my flyby for what I think is going on in teletherapy. I'll be spending most of my time with you, obviously, if I'm going to this topic right now, on homosexuality and what's going on in the world of the United States and actually the world more broadly in terms of gay marriage and reparation laws and so forth. If you would, take yourself to another handout here. I'll get to this piece in a minute, but you have a handout that is entitled CNN, obviously the news network, same-sex marriage in the United States by the numbers. Take a moment to peruse that. I don't need to read that to you all, but do a little seat work there, please. Check that out. Notice there are asterisks by the first four. And there's a footnote at the bottom. Let me talk to you about the footnote. Many of you are probably aware of this footnote information. This Monday, where else do you go to a conference and get a handout that says, this Monday something happened? But in our country and with this topic, it's probably very appropriate. This Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear cases from these five states that are listed there And they were seeking to keep their same-sex marriage bans in place. And appeals courts in those states had gone against the legislative ban and permitted same-sex marriage. That was what was going on. The bans are effectively nullified now because the Supreme Court didn't hear the cases. The decision also will bring along six other states located in the judicial circuits overseen by those appellate courts. North Carolina, as you can see, those states listed there. And because lower court judges in those states must abide by the higher court's rulings. This will likely bring the number of gay marriage rights states to 30, populated by about 60% of the U.S. So on Monday, this CNN article was published, or maybe it was Tuesday, I'm thinking. Yes, it was. On Tuesday, this article was published, and by the end of the day, it was out of date already. There are no longer, or there soon will no longer be 29 states that prohibit same-sex marriage. There will be 20. As there will be 30 states that support same-sex marriage. And it's not, item number four, 44% of the U.S. population living in a state that allows same-sex marriage. It'll be about 60. So those are the changes there. I think item number 10 is of particular interest. In 1969, 27%, about a fourth of the country of Americans thought same-sex marriage should be legal, and now it's more than half. So these numbers say to me that this is an important topic for us to consider as marriage and family therapists. As marriage therapists, what is marriage? The definition of marriage is radically, significantly, broadly changing in our Western culture and in our country. Back to the main handout, and I'm going to come back and address these, address therapy issues as we move on here. Something you may be aware of also, and this is an easy update, reparation therapy, which will be defined later, but which not quite the same as reorientation therapy, but reparation therapy in order to, the view typically of reparation therapy is that there's a same-sex person, same-sex attracted person, there's a dormant heterosexual tendency that that the therapy is attempting to restore. That's a little different than saying that someone has an orientation and they're working on altering actions about that orientation. So anyway, reparation therapy is illegal with minors in California and New Jersey. It's against the law to practice reparation therapy towards some sort of change in orientation for a person in those particular states. Let me take you back to the main handout where you're already there, and I need to get there myself. Looking at item three. Now, if you happen to endure professional studies with me one summer of your life as a student at Reformed Theological Seminary, and which notably at the end of those summer crammed ethical courses, the students and the professor say, "Whew, I am glad that is over, that there was some interesting information along the way, but by and large, it was just a talking head up there and looking at these issues. It didn't hold my interest that much." But I'm sure you'll remember that there's something called Kitchener's Psychological Process of Ethical Decision Making. Yes, you all remember that. Kitchener is actually quoted in the ethics literature very broadly in mental health and Kitchener proposed that what happens in the psychology of a human being, of a therapist who's trying to make an ethical decision about client care, and firstly, is just knowing, just having on the radar screen that this is a situation that requires an ethical decision. Now, I can really identify with this. There have been times in my life, and I think about ethics fairly often, at least annually during the summer, and hopefully more broadly than that. But, sometimes something takes me by surprise. I often tell the story, and I like this story, especially since Jim is here, because I don't think Jim's ever heard me tell this story before, that I was working with a couple, and therapy was going well, and he was a wealthy business owner, and we had done some of Sherrod Miller's Awareness Wheel in therapy, and he said, "This is great stuff. I have a host of managers in my business that I want to teach the Awareness Wheel." I said, excellent, super. As a matter of fact, this material has been adapted for the business workplace, and let's do it. And I kind of, I saw dollar signs, frankly, because consulting for a business is different than working with an individual client, right? Some of you are laughing because you know that the income level from individual clients is different from than it is from the corporate world in terms of consulting. And so I thought, hey, this is super. Well, about 3 or 4 days later, it suddenly hit me. They are with me in therapy. I will be, in essence, working for him. What does that do to our relationship? What does it do to my relationship with her? I am, and not only am I working for him, I'm working for him at a very happy financial level. And will I be still willing to confront him in therapy? And I talk to my friends on my usual Tuesday meeting, Jim and Barb, and probably Alice Fulton was here at that time. And they all agreed that not so good, Bill. So I recommended that Jim Hurley take the job. And he did, which affected my relationship with him significantly. So that was a surprise. But it didn't hit me at first. Maybe I was blinded by the dollar signs. And then, of course, formulating an ethical course of action. And Kitchener talks about, how do you formulate this? Where do you go? And you go to consensus. You go to your professional organization. And then choosing and following an ethical plan. All right, enough that. That's fairly simplistic. So gay issues. What informs Christian therapists at this formulation stage, at Kitchener's formulation stage? Where do we go? Well, I'm going to propose to you that we go primarily to three places. If you're a believer, you go to special revelation. Go to the Word of God. What does it say about homosexual relations? And these are four primary passages that address homosexuality in the scripture. And I spelled his name wrong. It's not Gangon, it's Gagnon. I apologize, Robert, for that. I don't know Robert. But I have discovered that Robert is a major proponent of conservative ethics relative to our culture's view on homosexuality. And is it right or is it wrong? And if you look at your reference page, which is right on the back of your main outline page, you'll see a couple of references for Gagnon. A major work, that's the second one, The Bible and Homosexual Practice, and a lesser number of pages, but a fascinating book called Homosexuality in the Bible, Two Views. I have never seen a book before that actually has two proponents of different viewpoints, putting forth their arguments for their viewpoints, and then critiquing one another, and then critiquing one another's critiques of them. I've seen that in journals, and you have too. This book is devoted to this, and Gagnon is on the conservative side of it. If you'd like to see what he believes, I recommend this book. If you'd like to see what an opposing view is, these persons are both doctoral level New Testament seminary professors, and they see things differently. I suppose I'll start telling this story now. I have a story to tell you about my learning in around this area of homosexuality and marriage and family therapy or counseling or psychology and just life in itself. So I'll start telling you about a friend of mine whose name is Susan. It's her real name. Her name is Susan McConnell. She doesn't mind that I tell you her name. She is she's a therapist. She lives in Chicago. I met Susan. Before I met Susan, I learned about Susan's gracious hospitality. A good friend of mine needed to travel regularly to Chicago for some specialized trauma therapy. And she happened to meet Susan, and Susan's partner at that time, Beth, was the two women were and are lesbian partners. She happened to meet Susan, and Susan and Beth opened their home to her on a monthly basis. This friend of mine, who was a conservative evangelical believer, was telling me about this gracious, kind, giving couple and their hospitality, and she was just amazed. And for many, many months, on just about a monthly level basis, maybe more frequently, she had traveled to Chicago. Finances were tight, and room and board were supplied by this couple, with no hope of any return, just pure giving. That's how I first heard. That's how I was first introduced to Susan, and then about a year later, at a professional conference for internal family systems therapy, I was attending. I met Susan. And I attended a workshop of hers and found her to be very gracious and kind, an excellent teacher. As a matter of fact, she and her partner, who was also a therapist, co-taught a class. I still am reaping the benefits of learning from them in that particular class. It was not about lesbianism or gay therapy, but it was about working with women in therapy and a feminist kind of a perspective, and it was just very, very helpful to me. A couple of years later, when I went back to another IFS conference in Chicago, I met Susan again, and I enjoyed relationship and fellowship and food with her, but her partner wasn't there, Beth, because Beth was down here volunteering on the coast to help people post-Katrina. By the grace of God and the mercy of Reformed Theological Seminary, in 2011, I did some more internal family systems training in France. And it was a delicious experience in metaphor and in reality. It was just a lovely gig, you might say. And Susan was that was about a three-week period. For half of that period, Susan was the teacher. She was the prime teacher. Of course, she would teach in English, which I understood, and then it would be translated in French, which was kind of beautiful and kind of lovely. And then I had time to kind of digest things, and as I was surrounded by beautiful French sounds, and later on, beautiful French food and wine at lunch, because they ate big lunches and drank enjoyable beverages at lunch in France. What can I say? So that may have flavored flavored my viewpoint, but I really, really got to know Susan there. I'm finding myself thirsty. And learned a little bit about Susan's background at that time. She had been married for 9 years to a Presbyterian minister, and their relationship was distant, and Susan kept wanting to be in therapy and renew their intimacy, and it was one of those situations that we men can be so guilty of, saying, oh no, you don't want to talk about intimacy again, which is not very intimate. And but it wasn't a humorous situation, and that she had a little daughter at that time, 6 years old or something like that. But at any rate, so that ended in divorce. And Susan told me a bit about that, and I remember one day, I've told a number of you this story probably, it was after a lunch break or something, some sort of break, and we were going back, and it was the fall in France, and we were meeting in a monastery, using part of that facility, and it was just a beautiful place, beautiful day, and I was walking along with Susan, and she just out of the blue, she said, "You know, Bill," of course she knows I'm an evangelical Christian. I say of course, but she did, and she said, "You know, Bill, I miss Bible studies." She's a Buddhist also, by the way, and so she's in a very different space and place than she used to be. But and I remember her saying that, and at any rate, the reason I'm telling you this, there's more to come about this story with Susan and what I've learned about the homosexual world from her. I had very recently, in preparing for this talk, I've spent about three hours, I think, somewhere between 2 and 3, with Susan on the phone, getting more information about her and homosexuality and her life and how did this happen? How did this come about? Is this reaction to something painful or traumatic? Was this something dormant, it seemed like all... So much I don't know. I mean, how often do you have a chance to interview someone about their homosexuality if you're an evangelical Christian? And Susan and I have, I thought, that kind of relationship, and she said, "I'd be honored." In fact, we were going to do a live interview. But as we started discussing these things, and she began with, "Well, Bill, let me ask you something first. What do evangelicals believe about homosexuality? Bill, what do you believe?" And so I took her through these scriptures. And I've read these scriptures many, many times. You probably have too. We start off in Genesis mildly with God created male and female in his image. And God said that for this reason, should a man leave his parents and be joined to a woman. And then when we get to Leviticus, then we talk, then the scripture gets a little harder to talk about with someone, because it says if a man would lie with another man like he would normally a woman, that he should be killed. Well, so I had the unique experience of trying to explain what I believe as an evangelical Christian to Susan, and I'd never done that before. I just assumed she knew what I believed. And I assumed I knew what she believed. So anyway, these are the scriptures that are primary, and I recommend the books that are referenced there. I'll tell you one more little piece of the story. As we were going through the scriptures, and I talked about Romans chapter 1, where the apostle Paul writes a theological letter explaining Christianity, and at first he sets out to say that he's not ashamed of this wonderful gospel, and then right after that he talks about basically mankind rejecting God, moving away from him in total depravity, and that's of course where homosexuality with men and women is listed in a fairly long list of sins, and other sins are right alongside, like greed and cheating and lying. And as I talked to Susan about that passage, one of those things happened that I love about life. I was surprised by her response. She said, "Well, wait a minute, Bill. Let me think about this for a minute. So you're telling me that," and by the way, she has been with Beth as her partner for 30 years, and since changing of laws in Illinois, in August they were married. And she said, "Bill, you're telling me that my love for Beth, who's been so kind and so good to me, that that's in the same category as greed and lust and cheating." She said, "Greed and cheating and lying, those things seem to me, as an IFS therapist, to be so fear-motivated, parts of us afraid, and so we lie and hide." And she said, "I just don't, my relationship with Beth doesn't seem like it's fear-based. It seems to me like it's love-based, but you're telling me that those are in the same category." And that was a tough part of the conversation for me. But I saw her point. And I can tell you that as I tried to dialogue with her further, I did a lot of stumbling and stuttering. It was an interesting moment, and she's very gentle and saying, "Well, okay, so I understand that, you know, that you put those in the same category." And she said, "That's surprising to me." She's very, some of you in this room probably know Susan, and said, "Anyway, she seemed a lot calmer than I did explaining it at the time." So as I think of those scriptures, I think of that recent experience. But we also go to general revelation, we believe, and we're cultural mandates, information, creation information. And for these two categories, I think as therapists, we go to our profession, we go to our ethical codes, we go to the thinking in our fields. And I think that actually is general revelation. I think that if you have some sort of consensus for many men and women who are experienced in therapy, who are made in the image of God, if you have some sort of consensus, that there's probably going to be some good general revelation information to come out of that. And it's a little odd maybe to call it general revelation, because it's not like what we're learning from trees and rocks and the animal world around us, but it's a consensus of image of God, people. It doesn't mean it'll be 100% accurate, but I think that's why we as evangelicals can find agreement with codes of ethics. I mean, obviously, you know, there are a number of the pieces of the code of ethics that you and I are just like, yeah, absolutely, no sex with clients, good idea. Yeah, but that always hasn't been seen as a good idea by therapists. Back in the 70s, there was a little bit more openness to nude encounter groups and sex with therapists as learning experiences and so forth. But I'm old enough to recall that. I was a baby, probably, but anyway. So knowledge of our profession, and then knowledge of the research in our field. An obvious example, which many of you hopefully recall, you know, the research says that if you're working with a woman and she has symptoms of something like a battered wife or battered woman syndrome, you don't prioritize autonomy as you begin with her. We found out in the research that doesn't work very well, because she stays there and she continues to be battered. The research says the most successful therapist is therapy in that situation is the more directive therapy that deprioritizes autonomy and prioritizes safety. And then when she's safe and out of that dangerous situation, then you foster her autonomy and her own decision-making a little bit more in therapy. So that's a directly research-related ethical decision to be made. So we're gonna do that. We're gonna look at the profession, and we're gonna look at knowledge of research, and so forth. And then I have a third item. C, accurate knowledge of. I'm not gonna tell you now. Just not, because it's a fascinating kind of a new learning piece for me there, and a new thinking piece. And so we'll get that. We'll get there in a moment. It's now 9:20, and at 9:30 we're gonna have a guest lecturer. It's Terry Heitz. We'll be here. Just in case you thought Susan was coming, Terry will be here. So, but we're gonna forge onward here a little bit for 10 minutes. And by the way, I didn't tell you my scheme of presentation. It's sort of a bookend thing. And those of you who know Hebrew, there's some word for that. Chiastic? Is that it? I'm not sure. But at any rate, we're going to start with Bill and ethics for about an hour. And then we're going to have three guest speakers that are graduates of Reformed Theological Seminary, Marriage and Family Therapy, or Marriage and Family Therapy and Counseling, depending on how old they are, and when they graduated. And they're going to talk about their world and how ethics and ethical decision-making comes to play in there. And so that'll be then the last hour will be Bill again talking more about this same topic. So that's our plan. Knowledge of the profession and research. See handouts, APA guidelines for psychological practices with lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender persons. So if you'll now dig into your stack of handouts once again, please, you will, APA guidelines, let's see, they may be a little out of order here, they are out of order somehow. I was my own secretary for making these handouts because I was so late in finishing them. Yes, here last night till 9:30 making copies, which is early for me. Normally it's the morning of, about 5 o'clock. But so anyway, if you keep digging, it might not be in the right order, but you'll find the APA guidelines. The guidelines for psychological practice with lesbian, gay, bisexual clients adopted here, as you can see, in 2011. Once again, a task force. Everyone finding that okay? Okay. Attitudes. Psychologists strive to understand the effects of stigma. Good idea. Psychologists understand that lesbian, gay, and bisexual orientations are not mental illness. That's a big piece in the field today. This is not mental illness as it once was thought to be in terms of our professional field. I think up to DSM-2, it was homosexuality was considered an illness. So you're going to see in the literature, it's not an illness and it doesn't need to be treated. That will be the logic there. Psychologists understand that same-sex attractions, feelings, and behavior are, here's a phrase that comes up over and over again in all the professional guidelines and literature, it's a normal variant of human sexuality. That is the viewpoint taken. And efforts to change sexual orientation have not shown to be effective or safe. Now, when we get to research, we're going to actually look at some research and some researchers that do challenge that. But nevertheless, that is the statement from APA, and that same statement is on the web of AAMFT. Is there anything else I want to highlight there? As you can move on and read through that. Also, let's look at guideline 12. You'll see I have reproduced 10 of the guidelines here. There are more than that. And item number 12 is particularly highlighted in the next handout on influences of religion and spirituality. And this is what the American Psychological Association, again, sort of the mothership of the helping professions and ethical codes, the influence of religion, spirituality in the lives of gay and lesbian persons can be complex, dynamic, and a source of ambivalence. Such is the case because their experience is very diverse. While some religious and spiritual belief systems are relatively neutral about diverse sexual orientations. Others historically have been condemnatory. Even within religious traditions that have been historically disapproving of non-heterosexual orientations, there has been emerging a growing theological paradigm in the last 20, 30 years that accepts and supports, and indeed it does. The religious backgrounds of lesbian, gay, and bisexual individuals may have variable effects on their psychological functioning, well-being, besides their diverse past experiences. They differ in terms of role that religion and spirituality may take. For instance, while some of their faith traditions and spiritual beliefs as an important and integral part of their identity, others do not. Going down to application, psychologists strive to be aware and respectful of the diverse religious spiritual practices espoused by their clients. Again, you can peruse that on your own. There's a section in the APA guidelines as well that, interestingly enough, warns therapists about their own potential biases for or against lesbian and gay clients. Well, that's the beginning of our orientation there. Let's go back and see where we are. You'll find a handout that says Your House, Definitions and Etiology. For me, it's on the next page, perhaps you too. Many of you will have read something from or heard speak Mark Your House. He and Erica Tan and Stan Jones, who's was the head of the psych department at Wheaton College and now is the provost over Wheaton, and some other folks that they partner with. These are the leading researchers in the evangelical world regarding homosexuality, reparation therapy, reorientation therapy. Their work is absolutely stellar. If you haven't done much with it, I absolutely recommend it. So let's look at these definitions, and then we'll let Terry Height talk to us about something very different. We've already spent a little bit of time, Terry, talking about teletherapy, and thanks for being here. I'll introduce you to him in a moment. Sexual identity refers to the act of labeling oneself with reference to one's sexual preferences. You can read there the common labels. About 3.5% of adults adopt a lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender identity. Sexual attraction refers to feelings of emotional interest in others. Estimated that 5 to 11% of adults experience at least some same-sex attraction. Sexual orientation, a more enduring pattern of attraction to another based on one's sexual desire. There are many debates in our culture about sexual orientation, particularly about the cause of sexual orientation and whether it is immutable, whether it's an immutable characteristic. Orientation is often discussed in our culture as heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual. The prevalence estimates for adult homosexual orientation, about 2 to 3%. We've probably already seen some of those, and you see the reference there. Let's also do the etiology. All of these little paragraphs are excerpted from Your House's writing, and they're all heavily referenced. He's a quintessential researcher and a careful documenter of his facts. While those aren't represented here, you can easily find them on the references that I've given you. The relationship between biology and sexual orientation is not one that follows the popular narrative being advanced. It is not just like eye color or hair color. This is what he believes from the research that he has read and conducted, of course. It is not just like race. Rather, while there is no exact parallel, it appears to be more like a predisposition or a push in the direction of the same-sex attraction and orientation for some people. That predisposition In his view, that predisposition is likely weighted more heavily for some people than for others. The fact that your house has been researching this for many years and that this is his conclusion is not lost on me. That's a significant conclusion. And it's going to be a significant piece of information when he talks about therapy with adult persons who do not want to follow the same-sex attraction that they find inside of them. That if there is not an orientation equation, or an orientation is a part of the equation for what type of therapy helps what persons, therapy is a very different world than homosexual behavior. If there's not an orientation dimension, is all choice. And I think you see this in our culture. On the right, especially evangelical Christianity, homosexuality is all choice. It is a sinful behavior. It's a wrong behavior. Therefore, it is choice and can be chosen otherwise. On the other end, you hear from our culture, no, it's eye color, it's hair color, it's orientation, and to ask a person to change or to think about changing is cruel. Yarhouse says the push is not determinative, it is neither decisive or conclusive. Other factors appear to be in play, and the other factors will be environment. Nurture also appears to play some role in the origin of sexual behavior. Unfortunately, proponents of this aspect have focused almost exclusively on parent-child relationships, sort of a psychodynamic model. And he rightly says that these findings are just not consistent, are not supported by the research. Actual studies of environmental influence point to a wide range of considerations. Well, there we have some beginning definitions, and now we have an intermission.